Mr. Srila Prabhupada.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th Canto, Chapter 19, Text 14. So it says? Good. Okay.
Yatahi kamusmika kamalampata suteshu dareshu daneshu chintayan sanketa vidvan kukale varatyayad yastasya yatna shrama eva kevalam yatahi kamusmika kamalampata suteshu dareshu daneshu chintayan sanketa vidvan kukale varatyayad yatasya yatna shrama eva kevalam yatahi kamusmika kamalampata suteshu dareshu daneshu chintayan sanketa vidvan kukale varatyayad yastasya yatna shrama eva kevalam.
Ladies. Yataha, as. Ahika, in the present life. Amusmika, in the expected future life. Kamalampata, a person who is very attached to lusty desires for bodily enjoyment. Suteshu, children. Dadeshu, wife. Daneshu, wealth. Chintayan, thinking about. Sanketa, is afraid. Vidvan, a person advanced in spiritual knowledge. Kukalevara, of this body, which is full of stool and urine. Atyayat, because of loss. Ya, anyone. Tasya, his. Yatna, endeavors. Shrama, a waste of time and energy. Eva, certainly. Kevalam, only. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Materialists are generally very attached to their present bodily comforts and to the bodily comforts they expect in the future. They are always absorbed in thoughts of their wives, children, and wealth, and are afraid of giving up their bodies, which are full of stool and urine. If a person engaged in Krishna consciousness, however, is also afraid of giving up his body, what is the use of his having labor to study the shastras? It was simply a waste of time. Purport. At the time of death, the materialist thinks of his wife and children. He is absorbed in thinking of how they will live and how they will take care of them and who will take care of them after he leaves. Consequently, he is never prepared to give up his body. Rather, he wants to continue to live in his body to serve his society, family, friends, and so on. Therefore, by practicing the mystic yoga system, one must become detached from bodily relationships. If despite practicing bhakti yoga and studying all the Vedic literature, one is afraid of giving up his bad body, which is the cause of all his suffering, what is the use of his attempts to advance in spiritual life? The secret of success in practicing yoga is to become free from bodily attachments. Srila Narottam Das Thakur says, Deha smriti nahi yara, samsara bandhana kahantara. One whose practice has freed him from the anxieties of bodily needs is no longer in conditional life. Such a person is freed from conditional bondage. A person in Krishna consciousness must fully discharge his devotional duties without material attachment. Then his liberation is guaranteed. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminite Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Govardhavani Pacharne Nivashesha Sunyavadi Pastajadi Shatarne Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasiddhi Govarda Bhakti Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So the first thing that came to my mind when I was reading this purport, Prabhupada's first few sentences, he's talking about the materialist, you know, the mental condition of the materialist at the time of death, about how he thinks of his wife and his children. He's absorbed in thinking of how they will live and who will take care of them after he leaves. And consequently, he's never prepared to give up his body. He wants to continue to live in his body to serve society, family, friends, and so on. And I was thinking, wow, compared to what my perception of what's going on today, that sounds pretty elevated. I don't even think people today are on that level, if that's possible. I mean, I remember I was on Sankirtan once, and I met this old couple. The guy must have been, they must have been at least in their 80s. They were old. And so I was talking to him, and I can't remember much of the conversation. There's one thing he said that really stood out in my mind. He explained to me that he was going skiing. He said, "We're going ski." Actually, he said, "We're going ski." He said, "You know what that is?" He's 80 years old. They're from New Zealand. I said, "No, what's that?" He said, "Spend the kids' inheritance." Ski. Spend the kids' inheritance. You know, And I realized, that was like a new trend now. Like the parents, they're not thinking about, like, I got to save a lot of the money and give it to my children so they can live nicely after we're gone. No, that wasn't his mood at all. His mood was, let's spend it while we can, spend the kids' inheritance. So I think there's a lot more of that going on. I think as Kali Yuga progresses, people become more and more grossly selfish and less concerned about, society, friendship, like that, family. So that was one thing that observation I made, at least one thought that popped in my mind when I was reading this purport. And then Prabhupada says here, by practicing mystic yoga system, one must become detached from bodily relationships. So somebody might ask, well, what is Prabhupada, why is he suggesting practicing mystic yoga system here? Well, the thought that came to my mind in relation to that was that Prabhupada does mention in several different places that if one is too attached, there is those statements, if one is too attached to the, material body, the gross material body and gross material body sense gratification, that the Hatha Yoga system is recommended. There are a couple statements like to that effect. So maybe that's what he's referring to here, because obviously he's talking about, the first part of this purport is talking about a materialist, gross materialist. And so perhaps for them, if they're not fortunate and they're just too attached, then okay, maybe they can, by practicing the mystic yoga system, they can become detached. But then the next sentence, he goes on, he makes the contrast, is that if despite practicing bhakti yoga, like in those, on the other hand, if somebody, despite practicing bhakti yoga and studying all the Vedic literature, one is afraid of giving up his body, which is the cause of all suffering, what is the use of his attempts to advance in spiritual life? In other words, we shouldn't be. That's what that's saying in so many words, that we shouldn't be afraid to give up our, in this bad body, which is the cause of all suffering. Those of us who are practicing bhakti yoga. Now, there are different aspects to being afraid of giving up the body. So we can talk about that. One aspect, the main primary aspect that's being mentioned in this translation in purport is the attachment to the sense gratification that you have in this lifetime. In other words, like there are some people, not a lot of people these days, but there are some people who, are enjoying a pleasant life. They have a nice, they have money, they have a nice family, they have prestige, nice position in society, and they don't want to give that up. So that's one aspect of being, not wanting to die. Another aspect of it is the fear of the suffering and the pain that one experiences as one is about, in the process of dying. And another aspect is the fear of non-existence. So let's take three different aspects. So certainly for the devotee, we should definitely not be at all concerned of the fear of non-existence. That wouldn't make any sense at all. I mean, you're not much of it, because there's so many, statements throughout all the shastras, all the Vedic literatures. I mean, the first lesson in the Bhagavad Gita is we're not this body. So if after studying, as it says here, if after studying the Vedic literature, in the translation it says, after studying the shastras, a devotee is afraid of non-existence, then the penny hasn't dropped. And we just haven't got it, I mean, that's, can't be. But, and then, of course, so that might sound like, but of course, that's obvious. But it's not obvious to a non-devotee. Like, for instance, I'll give you an example of somebody who would fit this description perfectly of a person afraid of death. Walt Disney. Walt Disney, everybody's heard of Walt Disney, Disneyland. Obviously, I don't know much about his life, but other than that, he was very successful and probably very wealthy and probably very clever, too, because, he was the founder or chair of Disneyland. So he was a clever man. He was no fool. But he was so much an illusion, despite all his material cleverness, he was so much an illusion that he really feared non-existence to the point where he became involved. I don't know if he was he initiated it or if he just kind of signed up for a program called Cryogenics, which is that when you die, just before you die, and I hope I'm getting this right because I haven't studied up on it, they drain the fluids from your body and they put in some other kind of fluid. So they do something. There's some sort of you know, thing that goes on. Basically, they try to preserve your body. And you know, this is what cryogenics is all about. They try to preserve your body, freeze it, basically, you know, and keep it in a state of suspended animation. This is the hopes of cryogenics, that they freeze your body by putting it in a state of suspended animation. And then when they find out the cure for death, when science, you know, modern medical science figures out how to avoid death, then they'll bring you back, and you know, bring you back again, and you'll be alive. So Walt Disney had that done to him. He had that done. He, you know, his, I don't know if it's still in that state now or whatever, but it still is. What? Still waiting. Yeah, he's still waiting. Yeah, still waiting, of course. He's still chilling, as I said. So that's, you know, just an example, so, you know, that we don't think that this is ridiculous. I mean, there are people who think like that. I met somebody when I was on Sankirtan this weekend. He was an educated man. He was a teacher. And so when I approached him with the book, I said, thank you, but I don't need that. I don't need anything to tell me how to be a good person. I know how to be a good person. I said, oh, okay. I said, well, what about after you die? He said, well, when I'm dead, that's it. I said, what do you think happens? He says, well, you know, I die and they bury me and I'll become food for the plants and the trees and the grass and like that. I say, what about, you know, a spirit? And, you know, do you think there's a... He said, that's my spirit lives on in the good work I did, in the memory of the good work I did in the minds of other people. And I said, well, you don't believe in any kind of... personal survival, you know, survival of your individual personality. He says, no. So, you know, here's a man who's a teacher, educated man, but no way. Didn't believe in that. And so there's lots and lots of people in that category, you know, who they just really don't believe that there's anything after when you die. But so getting back to devotees, so, you know, definitely as for devotees, there should be no fear of non-existence. Even aside from all the statements in the Shastras, Jhutakarma, he did this very wonderful book, Human Devolution. And in that book, that book is a defense of his former previous book, The Forbidden Archaeology. Because the way he presented it once, I heard him speaking, was that he threw out a challenge there that this is not the way evolution happened. You know, anatomically modern human beings haven't just been around for 30,000-40,000 years, you know, as mainstream modern anthropology is saying. They've been around hundreds and thousands, perhaps millions of years. So we reject that picture. We reject that picture of reality. So supposedly he got the challenge back to him and says, well, if that's not the way it happened, how did it happen? And that's why he wrote the book Human Devolution as a response to that challenge that, well, if it didn't happen this way, how did it happen? So he proceeds to explain in that book that human beings, before we could talk about the evolution of human beings, we have to define what is a human being. So he comes out and explains in the book that human being means is a combination of matter, mind, and spirit. Three different things, not just one. You know, not just matter, as mainstream science would have us think, but matter, mind, and spirit. And he proceeds in some of the chapters in the book to present empiric evidence, you know, to support the idea that there is a mind element and a spirit or a consciousness element. And interestingly enough, he does that from the research of scientists that were contemporaries of Darwin, around the same time period as Darwin, 1850 to about, you know, 1900, like that. Which was, particularly interesting. Anyway, he does a really good job of that, you know. And that there were so many prominent scientists. You know, some of them were Nobel Prize winners, about six or eight of them, or something like that. And they did this different research in the areas of, communications from the dead, apparitions of the dead, demoniac possessions, and now later on, in more recent times, research is being done in the area of near-death, out-of-body experiences. And children who have memories of their past lives. So there's all these different categories of evidence to support the idea that the survival of human personality, you know, the human personality goes on. And if somebody wants to, you know, even if somebody is, for some reason, if they are not fortunate enough to accept the authority of the Shastra, then just, you know, if just on the basis of that evidence, you could come to the conclusion that human personality survives the death experience. So for a devotee, we have absolutely zero reason to fear non-existence. That's there for sure. I personally am not afraid of non-existence. I can honestly sit here and say, 100%, I am not afraid that when I die, that's the end of me. 100%, you know, that I can say. Now, another aspect of it, the fear of the pain and the suffering, Prabhupada really doesn't address this, and I don't think this is particularly talking about that. But also another point is there's a difference between being afraid of something and concerned about something. You know, concern is okay. Like, you know, for instance, I think it's okay to be, and even in the in the Bhagavad Gita, in one purport, Prabhupada talks about how is that verse, is that where it goes, Janma Mrityu Jaravyadi Dukkha Doshana Darshanam, that one should see the disadvantages of birth, death, old age, and disease. And Prabhupada says in the purport, that's just one line of a very long verse there, but he says this, the disadvantage of these should be discussed. He said these are described in the Shastras, and the disadvantages of these items should be discussed. You know, and he explains why, that so one will have a pessimistic outlook towards material life, and as a result of having a pessimistic outlook towards material life, one will have an impetus to make advancement in spiritual life. See, so in other words, it's good to have intelligent concern about something like that, those items. That's not being afraid. You know, being afraid is when you do something like Walt Disney did, or something like that. That's, you know, but to understand the disadvantages of these things and make take precautions and make preparations to deal with that, you know, that's not being afraid. And when it's talking about being afraid of giving up the body, I don't, you know, the pain and the suffering. Well, as I said, it's not really so much mentioned here, but you know, I don't think it's a bad thing to be, you know, not want to. Everybody doesn't want pain or suffering, you know. But it's anyway. That's I don't even bother proceeding on that point. That's not being that's okay. That's legitimate. That's not considered being afraid of death. If you're concerned about, like say, a prolonged illness like cancer or something like that, where you're going to have to. Like, I don't think, like, you know, for instance, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, he had cancer and dragged on for about a year. So we don't want that. I mean, if that's what you got to deal with, you got to deal with it. But it's not like, you know, you want it. I mean, nobody in their right mind, basically, I don't think would have to go through something like that. But to not want that is not, that's not afraid. That's not what being referred to here anyway. So what else can we say here about this particular point? Oh yeah, so getting back onto that point about how devotees don't need to fear anything. You know, as I said, there's all these statements from the scriptures, and this is by, you know, the mercy of some of the disciples of Srila Prabhupada, Sataputta, Drudakarma, different devotees. You know, even have empiric evidence to support the conclusions that we're hearing in the, you know, from the scriptures. Of course, what's more important to us is the statements of the scriptures. Empiric evidence is always imperfect because of the defects of the conditioned soul. We have imperfect senses, and therefore we make mistakes. And when we make, you know, repeatedly making mistakes, so we're in illusion. And then due to false ego, even though, despite the fact that we're in illusion, we're presenting what we think we know as knowledge when it's not. We're just presenting our illusion. So we can never really take shelter of empiric knowledge, but it's interesting, and it's something worth noting when it supports the Vedic worldview, which in this case it does. So we have that, and then you have like in different statements. Like, for instance, for a devotee who's practicing Krishna consciousness, practicing bhakti yoga, There's that statement in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Nehapur kama nastosti prachavayana vijate svalpam apyasi dharmasha trayate mahatobayat. That in this endeavor there's no loss or diminution, and even a little bit of advancement protects one from the most dangerous type of fear. And in other words, if even if somebody engages in a little devotional service, that guarantees him a human body in his next lifetime. And then there's been different, I've heard different discussions, debates on just how little that can be. And I've heard it stated even to the point where, you know, devotees have told me that, I think it was Dave and Rita Swami heard Prabhupada say on a tape, he listened to it 13 times again and again, that you know, even if somebody just touches the book, they're guaranteed a human form of life. I've heard different things that it doesn't have to be much. I remember once I heard if somebody even gives a quarter on Sankirtan and buys what was that book, a pamphlet we were distributing? Reservoir of Pleasure. That will get him a human birth. I mean, you hear different things. But, and what exactly is the, how little you have to do to get the human birth, I don't know exactly. I can't say for sure. But it's not that much. You know, with even a little devotional service, you're guaranteed at least a human body. So certainly devotees who are living in a temple, chanting Hare Krishna, following the regulative principles, you know, et cetera, they're guaranteed a human body in the next lifetime. And beyond that, but more important than that, because you know, getting a human body, that's no big deal. You can get a human body and then just engage in all sorts of sinful activities and wind up going to hell. But more important than that is in the sixth chapter it states, a transcendental. It says, on taking such a birth, he revives his divine consciousness of his previous life, and he again tries to make further progress in order to achieve complete success, O son of Kuru. By virtue of his divine consciousness of his previous life, he automatically becomes attracted to the yogic principles, even without seeking them. So, this is referring to an unsuccessful yogi. Well, I think that, you know, devotees are bhakti yogis, so this does apply to us as well. Because, this is the sixth chapter. At the end of the sixth chapter, Krishna says, of all yogis, he who abides in me with great faith, worship me with transcendent loving service is most intimately united with me in yoga and is the highest of all. So I think when Krishna's talking here in the sixth chapter about yogis, bhakti yogis can be included because as far as he's concerned, that's the bhakti yogi is the highest form of yogi. So we're guaranteed that not only will we get a human birth again, but we will revive our divine consciousness of this life. And that'll happen automatically. We'll become attracted to the yogic principles, devotional service, and without even seeking it, and we'll just take up where we left off. So, what do we have to be afraid of? We're in a pretty good situation, and hopefully we'll go back to Godhead. Or, if not back to Godhead, hopefully we'll achieve pure devotional service, and we'll be able to continue in the material world as pure devotees serving the mission of Lord Chaitanya. Actually, I heard an interesting story about that. So I heard this over the weekend. A devotee told me he heard this from a devotee who heard it. Doesn't make sense. This devotee heard from a devotee who had darshan, and somebody asked Jai Patakamaraj, actually the devotee himself, this asked Jai Patakamaraj, what was it like having a stroke? And Jai Patakamaraj answered, he said, well, this is what I heard, okay, I'm just repeating what I heard, it's third hand, but this is what I heard. And he said the Vishnu Dutas came, and they were going to take me back to Goloka Vrindavan, but he gave him all sorts of arguments. He presented all sorts of reasons why he wanted to stay. And he persuaded them to let him continue. So I just, as I said, I don't know. I haven't had a chance. If I heard that 2 weeks ago, I would have went to Jai Patakamaraj and asked him, but he's already gone, so I can't ask him. But that's the story I heard. And the only thing I heard, my wife told me that the GBC had a meeting with him at one point because he was, they didn't think he was taking his recovery seriously enough because he kept going on traveling and preaching. And so they, you know, they were presenting the concerns to him. Maharaj, you know, you've got to slow down. This, you know, you're supposed to be recovering. You had a stroke. And he said, well, I had a very, you know, like he had a personal experience, in which he didn't give him the details. But he said, don't worry, I know what I'm doing, to that effect. He basically told him, don't worry, I know what I'm doing. So anyway, interesting. Of course, maybe hopefully he'll come back and we'll get to see him and ask him. We can ask him directly about that. But that's pretty far out. And last point on this thing of, you know, not being afraid of death. Devotees who are practicing this process seriously, they get confirmation on a regular daily basis of how this philosophy is the truth. Chanting in your service on a regular daily basis, you can experience confirmation how this is the absolute truth. So, you know, I'm. What time is it? 5 after? 8:11. Okay, I'll stop there. Anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah, Archdeacon.
But Krishna doesn't say that if you die in some supposedly horrible way, then you're not a pure devotee. Where does Krishna say that? Look at Bhishmadev. Bhishmadev died in front of Krishna, full of arrows. Can you imagine how painful that would be from a material perspective? Being shot through and through with so many arrows that he wasn't even touching the ground? What kind of horrible death is that? But because he was a pure devotee, he wasn't even feeling it. That's the whole point. The first installment of pure devotional service is that one is freed from the pains of material existence. If you read the Nectar of Devotion, you see that. That's the first installment. So if one is actually a pure devotee, it doesn't matter how he dies. He could be shot full of arrows, die in a car accident. It doesn't matter. The point is, if you're a pure devotee, then you're completely compact, as Prabhupada would say, with Krishna. You're always thinking of Krishna at every moment. And Bhishmadev demonstrated that. Even though he's shot full of arrows, he was only talking Krishna conscious subjects, called the Pandavas over and preached to them. He wasn't saying, where's the morphine? You know, no. Completely detached. So that's the point. If you're a pure devotee, it doesn't matter how you die. Whether it's cancer or being shot full of arrows or dying in a car accident, it doesn't matter. If you're a pure devotee, that means you're compact with Krishna and you're only with Krishna at every moment, and it doesn't matter what's happening to the body. Prabhupada even demonstrated that himself in his own passing. From a material perspective, to dwindle like that for months and months and be bedridden, and, you know, materialists would say, what a horrible death. But it was a glorious death because he was completely absorbed in Krishna at every moment. So we shouldn't judge. A lot of neophyte devotees are doing this. How did this person die? They died of cancer, they died in a car accident, etc., etc. Oh, they can't be a pure devotee, because Krishna wouldn't let a pure devotee die like that. That's nonsense. Bhishmadev, again, is a prime example. Shot completely full of arrows. He wasn't even touching the ground in front of Krishna. What kind of horrible death is that? But completely detached. Wasn't considering his circumstances at all. Simply absorbing Krishna, seeing Krishna, and preaching about Krishna.
Okay, let me ask a question. I agree with you. You know, the mode of death is, you know, not important. But what if somebody is not pure devotee enough so that they're, you know, kind of like it's difficult for them to tolerate that prolonged pain? I know Bhakti Tirthamraj, I don't think he took any morphine or anything like that, right? But I've heard of devotees who had a pretty tough trot there, and, you know, towards the end, and they did take some. Oh, he had to take. Yeah, right. So, I mean, I don't want to. I just wanted to clarify that because, I mean, if you're on that level, Prabhupada or Bhishmadev, and you're so transcendental that you don't even. The pain's not an issue for you, great. All glories to you, you know. But not everybody might be on that level. And in the event that somebody has to take a bit of something or other, whatever they need to take in order to just, you know, get on with it. As long as they don't lose faith in Krishna, I mean, you know, you're keeping your faith in the philosophy and everything, that's okay. Well, that's okay too, I think. I mean, according to Vijaya, even Bhakti Tirthamaraj had to take a bit of morphine. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we have an example of Jayananda. Jayananda Prabhu, he was taking medications as his, you know, illness progressed. Sometimes he would take, sometimes he wouldn't take. They took him to Mexico for some certain treatment. But the point is, he was always preaching Krishna consciousness. Mukunda Maharaj tells a story that he was driving with him when they were going to Mexico for certain treatment, and they stopped in a gas station. There was a blue devotee there who was, you know, pumping the gas. And Jayananda was just preaching to him.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, he was absorbed. When he passed, Prabhupada didn't ask, you know, was he taking medications and that. He just asked the circumstances. And based on the circumstances, the time of day, and what his consciousness was, and where Prabhupada said,
right, right.
Okay, he left.
When you say medication, I was specifically referring to pain medication.
Yeah, so I'm just saying, that's, you can't judge by that either. That's another thing that we try to judge. Did the person take medication? Oh, they're not a pure devotee. You know, we can't judge by that. Krishna says, whoever's thinking of me at the time of death, that's what matters. So we tend to judge by the external circumstances. You know, where, why, how, and did they take this and that. That's not what determines whether you're a pure devotee or not. It's your consciousness of Krishna. So Jayananda, I think we all agree, he left in a glorious way. So it didn't matter that he had been taking some medication sometimes or not. Sometimes he completely, you know, just went against the medical advice. He ate a whole tub of pakoras because he, you know, he wanted prasadam. That was completely against what he advised. It wasn't that he was trying to save his body. You know, he was doing what was Krishna conscious at every moment. So that's what you judge by. But, and it's very difficult. My point is, it's not really our place to judge who was pure at the time of death or not. Don't even worry about that. Just try to be Krishna conscious, because every living entity has that relationship with Krishna. And Krishna can, if at the very last moment, actually states, and I think in the 12th canto or 11th canto, Krishna makes a statement that whoever chants my name or hears my name chanted, forget which, at the time of death, I personally come and take them to their original situation. So all the other preceding circumstances make no difference. At that final moment, if you remember Krishna or chant Hare Krishna or remember Krishna's name, Krishna personally comes and takes you.
Okay, good note to end on. Thank you very much. Gandharva Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.